Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Ken, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. With 1 year or more of sobriety, tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipsSpeakers.org will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And now I get to introduce the introducer, Rusty Jones.
I'm Rusty Jones. I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Hey, Rusty.
And it is my honor tonight to introduce you to Brett, who's a true friend of mine. A true friend is someone who's there for you, who works a good program. Brett has really been there for me, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, Rusty.
I'm Brett, and I am definitely an alcoholic. There's a lot of people here who are brand new in sobriety and new to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm going to give a very short snippet to sort of give you an overview of where, how this can relate to you in today's modern time, coming from people who were living in the 1930s. Alcoholics Anonymous began when Ebby came to Bill, and they had a talk, and Bill acknowledged that he had a problem. That was just the beginning. He acknowledged he had a problem, and he ended up going to a place called Christ Church in New York City. There he met Sam Schumacher, who became his actual sponsor. Sam wrote a thing called a poem, and this is in 1935. He wrote a poem, and that poem is, the name of it is, I Stand by the Door. The importance of that poem is actually later, 5 years later, when he wrote the book that gave us our name. The title, Alcoholics Anonymous, came from our book. Bill got sober in a thing called the Oxford Groups, and the two men who founded the Oxford Groups were Sam Schumacher, his sponsor, and Frank Buckman. All right. So he was really God had it and put him in the right place at the right time to be next to a man. But Sam's poem about I Stand by the Door is actually the structure of what our program is about. It's about for us to pass it on to you so that we can enrich our own relationship with that power greater than ourselves through the process of helping you find it for yourself. That's what we do. The mechanism that we utilize to help you get there are the 12 steps. And in the 12 steps, we start with the first three. Those are just preparation. Those are acknowledging, the very first one is acknowledging you have a problem. Now, 1933 is the height of a Great Depression. If you have a physical problem today, you have a financial problem, you're feeling like your life is upside down and backwards. These guys were living through a very heavy, hard, dark time in the 30s, right? So I'm giving you a context that lets you know that this book, while seemingly from a different time, is actually very much relevant to us today in our modern time. So the first step, acknowledge there is a problem. I had a problem with alcohol. There wasn't any but doubt about that for me. Then I had to decide that I needed help to get better, but I didn't know what was wrong with me. Well, they described it as a twofold, an allergy. I have an allergic reaction. When I put alcohol in me, my one drink wants 20 more. Right? That's the nature of my reaction. And people who have a similar reaction with other drugs, they put a little in and they want a lot more. So that's my experience as well. Okay? So then the second part of it, though, that's just the allergy. The insanity that tells me, oh, doesn't matter the train wreck that this caused in my life. Doesn't really matter. It'll be different this time. How many of us have told ourselves that? Just saying. So that's insanity. You know, to think that it's going to be different next time, no matter how much proof you've got that it won't be, how many times you've done it. That's insanity. So that's the reason the second step says restore the sanity. It's not just about the other aspects of sanity. It's about the insanity of the first drink. And that's what that part of step two is talking about. But step three is where we decide. We make a decision. Okay, there's a power out there greater than myself, because my power by itself was not sufficient to stop me from doing stupid shit and going back to do it again. So I needed a power greater than me, outside of me, to help me to get there. So I acknowledged that there is a power, that something outside of me, and I saw people in here who, you could look in their eyes and you could see something different. They were alive. I wasn't. See it in their life and you want what they have, then you become willing to do what they did to get it. Now it comes to the God issue. I fought God tooth and nail. I argued, I gave God my Christmas list, and he didn't meet it on my timeline, so I had to let him go. But that was it. That was what it was. But what I didn't realize is that selfish prayers are never going to work. They never are. Never. The only thing I can do is when I can get honest about things and go to something outside of myself and say, this is me, this is my experience, God, help me to understand how to behave and help me to calm down and work through this and get through this. And that's basically the basis for what step three is about. But you don't know what you're going to turn over. You're going to turn over things and try to start living life on a different basis. You don't know what you're turning over until you get past step three. So step three is a decision to move forward and do the rest of the step work. All 1 through 3 is a recognition that there is a problem and a preparation to begin to transform. Steps 4 through 9 are transformation. I'm willing to transform. I'm going to do it. And the minute you get to step 3, you don't stop at step 3. A lot of people will get to step 3 and they'll bang. You know, that's called a waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, out. You don't want to waltz right out the door and get drunk again. So the trick is, when you do 3, launch. Do the step work with somebody who's done the step work, and you get some great benefits. You get to have your eyes look like the eyes of the people who have done it before, and you can see that their lives have been transformed. So my experience is, you get prepared, you acknowledge there's a problem, you become willing to be transformed, you do the work in 4 through 9 to be transformed, and then after that, for the rest of your life, you're going to live in steps 10, 11, and 12 to stay transformed and to be happier in your own skin, to continue to grow in understanding and effectiveness, and to be happy in your own skin. So I just wanted to give you, because you're new to this program, I wanted y'all to know what this program is really about. That's what we're about. And we're here to help one another do that, to have a relationship with a power outside of ourselves, bigger than us, to come to understand that it is real, that prayer life works, that there's you know, there's four primary prayers in this program that are strong and that really help you get through the day and can help you grow and continue to grow. With that much, now I'll tell you my story. I was born in Marianna, Florida, in what you could only call a redneck mecca. Every day at noon, rednecks all over the world roll out their camouflage prayer rugs and bow toward Marianna. It's not pretty. I left there when I was young. My real father was an alcoholic. My grandfather was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. Give you an idea about my real father. My real father didn't want to pay his child support or alimony, and the judge told him, okay, John David, say you don't have any money, sell your damn airplane, and pay your alimony and child support. My father, being a good alcoholic, did the only reasonable sane thing. He went out to the airport and set his plane on fire and burned it to the ground. But he wasn't an alcoholic or nothing. So anyway, but I wasn't, you know, going to be an alcoholic because, you know, just because he was, it didn't mean that I had any problems. Now, I started skipping school when I was in second grade. I hadn't had any alcohol or drugs or anything, but I needed some. I mean, in second grade, I was restless, irritable, and discontented, and crazier than hell. Wild as a cob. I mean, just ready to go. And I get into a little bit of trouble here and there, not much. And then I discovered alcohol. Yeehaw. I had more than I had a lot of advantages as a kid. I grew up in a town here called Avondale. Now it's just small enough that they had their own little police force, and it was possible to know all the policemen and the chief of police. And it was also possible to know the judges. So if I got in trouble, I could meet the judge at the tennis court ahead of time and go in and say, I don't care, I'll pay any fine, I'll do anything you say, just don't tell my dad. Now my stepdad was different than my real father in that he would just take one or two drinks. He needed 20, but he only took one or two, and he was angry all of the time. Now, the men in my family, my real father and my stepfather, we can say the men in our family have relative ability. They go to work for relatives because they make more money that way. My real father worked for his father, and my stepfather worked did everything through banks and family members that helped him do whatever he wanted to do. The alcoholism really, in my real father's case, was nobody else would have hired him. For me, I worked for my stepdad. Worked down at the Atlanta Merchandise Mart. I had a need to impress. My drinking really hadn't hit its heyday yet. I was in high school. I was drinking some. I was getting into a little bit of trouble, but I was always finding a way to get out. And I was working the system. I mean, working it. I worked people. Supposed to be around people and be with people and stuff and use things, but I used people and had things. It was a wrong attitude toward life in the world. I wanted more of everything. I always wanted more of everything. And I was jealous of people who got more. I went to a school where a lot of the people were wealthy. I was not the wealthy in the wealthiest crowd. I just sort of felt like I always felt less than. But I always had to prove that I was more than somehow. I was drinking and drugging, and in elementary school, I stole some of my mother's medicines and pretended it was medicine it wasn't. I didn't even know what the hell it was. I'm in the school trying to sell it. I mean, sixth grade. Yeah. I don't even know how I got out of that one. I got caught. It was bad. I don't even know. Did all kinds of crazy shit. I rolled cars. I center hung a car when I was was 18, and I had been drinking. I had gone to a fraternity party, and you know, we used to make these big old tubs of whiskey, grain alcohol, and we put fruit in it and punch. We call it hunch punch. And we would drink our hunch punch. I'm sitting there on 285 originally, you know, now the wall's this tall. Well, at that time they were just building the wall, and the wall was only that tall. And I kind of slid my car up on top of the wall, and the wheels are off both sides. And the policeman's got his lights on, and he's walking toward me, you know, and I roll my window down, and I stuck my head out the window, and he's in front of me, and he says, "What in the hell happened to you?" I ate the fruit. He said, "What?" I said, "I went to the fraternity party and I ate the fruit and the punch." You know, no, most normal people, this is 1970, probably 1978, you know, most people would have gone to jail. He drove me home. My car, he had the record service pull it down. It must have been end of shift for him. He just wanted to go to hell home. I think that's what it was, but it was 1978. So I got a ride home, and my car jerked down. All I had to do was pay the record people to get my car back. And so talk about, you know, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I should have had an ass whooping. By the way, one of the reasons I didn't get in trouble in Avondale very much is that both the mayor, the commissioner, the police commissioner, and most of the cops hated my dad. So they didn't want to go tell my dad anything. And they didn't want me to get in trouble because my dad had beat me bad. He was an ex-Golden Glove boxer, and he beat the hell out of me. This is my stepdad. The long and the short of it is I got away with murder, and it wasn't in my best interest that I had, unfortunately. I thought it was. I thought this was all great. But because I had no consequences, I just turned up the volume and accelerated. In school, I decided that I needed to go to Mexico for a vacation because the school thing was tough. They wanted you to go to class. Unreasonable people. Is anybody else, probably all of y'all, has anybody else failed public speaking? Okay, you're probably the only one, because I don't know many people that fail public speaking. And then music appreciation. All you got to do is sit your ass in a chair and listen to music. I failed music appreciation and public speaking. Now, public speaking, that was fair. I mean, I had done my speech the day before. I didn't think I was going to have to do any more speaking. And my buddy came by with, this is not strictly alcohol. It was blonde Lebanese hash on the end of a pen. But I lit it on fire, and we put it under a glass, and smoke came out, and I inhaled that smoke. And then I went into my public speaking class. And I walked up to the podium about like this, and I looked at the camera that was rolling, and I looked at the professor, and I looked at the two students who'd shown up that day, other than me. That's the reason I had to give mine. The 48 kids supposed to be in that damn class. Nobody showed up. That's why I had to give my speech. I looked down at my paper, looked back up at the camera, looked back at the professor. He said, "But I'm stoned." So I failed public speaking. That was an interesting semester. So I come back to school, and I had another hard semester where it was rigorous. I mean, these damn people, you got to go to class, you got to show up, you need to actually read a book. The bastard. It was tough. I needed a break, so I went to Mexico. I called back from Mexico, and I called Dean Thames. Now, again, I was always good at figuring out who was in charge, who was the guy, the pivotal people that you needed to know to suck up to. Because if y'all ever watch, y'all need to watch the Nature Channel sometimes. They got this thing called a lamprey. It sucks on the side of a whale, so about this long. Just sucks on the side of a whale, won't get off of nothing. I sucked up better than the best lamprey in the history of lampreys. I was sucking up, I'm telling you, I was sucking up to anybody and everybody to get me out of trouble. So I sucked up to the to Dean Thames, and Dean Thames, I called Dean Thames, I said, Dean Thames, I'm sorry, I'm down here in Mexico, and I don't see how I'm going to be able to make it back this semester. Will you be kind enough to withdraw me? He said, Mr. Price, that was taken care of 2 weeks ago for you. I didn't realize it was withdrawn failing, but that was another whole issue. I'm like, oh, my God. And I get back, and it was when my stepdad decided I needed to leave school and come back to work for him and spend all my time working for him. That was actually a moment in time where I did well for a minute. I tried to stay sober during that time frame for a little bit. I had some successes, and I had some successes because I wanted to show him, I'll show you. I'll do good, and I'll prove to you how great I am, and you will understand. So I did. I landed some good commercial accounts and made some things that made money. My stepdad decided that I was getting too big for my britches when I was being successful, so he gave me some comeuppance, and I got pissed off, and I did the only sane thing to do. I met a little German girl and moved to California and ran off and started drinking harder and faster and doing anything and everything that was in front of me. So I'm living in California, and I decided I'd go to a park. I'm living in San Clemente, and then there's a place, you got Beverly Hills, and then you got Woodland Hills right next to it. So I went to the cheap seats, Woodland Hills, right next to Beverly Hills. You know, those are the $4 million houses as opposed to the $40 million houses. So I go there and go party there. It was a good party. I mean, I remember pulling up to the place. 6 days later, I woke up in Birmingham. Don't really remember getting to Birmingham. Don't know where that car went. Have no idea to this day where that car went. I'm in this hospital, and I'm behind a glass door. This glass door is interesting. It's an architectural problem, by the way. The lock's on the wrong side of the door. I'm trying to explain to myself, and I'm looking around, and I look at the people who are in the room. These people are crazy. I walk to the nurse and the doctor. I walk up to them. These people are crazy. I am not crazy. And they said, Mr. Price, you came here. We believe you may be an alcoholic. Alcoholic? No, I'm crazy. If I'm an alcoholic, I have to stop drinking. I will outsmart them. And I did. And they decided, oh, well, if you're crazy, and I said, and not only that, you're not letting me out of here, so I'm depressed. I'm depressed and I'm crazy. So they said, well, we think first you're going to need some shock treatments. The law allows 12. You're going to get 13. Then, after that's over with, then we're going to give you these medications. You're going to take them exactly as prescribed. And you can't drink with them. You can take the drugs, but you cannot drink with them. The evil bastards. I had not quite outsmarted them the way I thought I had. Shock treatment compliance is a strange-ass thing. Because after you get enough shock treatments, your ass will comply. You're walking around like kind of a damn zombie. I'm going through life, and I am I'm doing what they said. And then gradually, over a short period, with no alcohol, with no gasoline poured on the fire, all of a sudden my life started spiraling up and going good. I mean, real good. Real good. And so for 4 years, everything was going great. I mean, well enough, I had a nice high-rise apartment here. I had an apartment in Nashville, Tennessee. I mean, I was living large. And then I had this great idea, because I had a keen alcoholic mind, by the way. I decided, I just washed my Xanax down with gin and tonic. What could go wrong? Oops. What was spiraling down took, life was going so incredibly well, and it went so incredibly bad, so incredibly fast. It didn't take long at all. I got drunk. I talked trash about an employer who I had been, actually, I had known these people since I was 7 years old. So when I burn bridges, I do it with napalm and maybe, you know, some nuclear weapons. You know, I do it bad, and that's what I did. It cost me dearly. And not only did it cost me dearly, it hurt me internally because my opinion of myself was already low on certain levels, but it went lower. That's the real problem. I have to treat that aspect, that soul sickness thing, is part of what the step work does. It helps me treat my incredibly low opinion of myself. I don't think I have a low opinion of myself until I actually say, oh, these are the people I hurt. This is the things that I've done. And it's not, thanks to the step work, I found out something. You know, I didn't get to the step work right away, but when I first got in here, I resisted it. You know, I had what you would call alcoholic dyslexia. You know, I wanted what you had and was willing to go to any length to avoid it. You know, it was just, I mean, no, it made no sense at all. I wanted what you had, was willing to go to any length to avoid it. And finally, in fighting it, when I first got here, I thought the 13th step was something that you did. But by the way, 13th step is when you come in and you start hitting on girls. And that's not a good thing to do. That's not a step, by the way. It's something you don't do. I'm trying to do anything to not do the step work, and I white knuckle it for 6 whole months in these rooms. I was sober, damn it. I was stark raving sober, and I was so dry I was a fire hazard. And I was just nuts. I went and I picked up my 6 month chip, and I got it. And by God, I got it, and I'm going to a party with my brother tonight. There's a girl there. Her daddy had been on a local radio station here. She's a really pretty girl. I mean, I had a bad crush on this girl. And I'm at the party with my 6 month chip, and I'm walking in my pocket, and I'm walking around behind her, and they're passing the joints around, and they're handing people beers near me, and I'm just laser focused on the girl. I'm like, wherever she's going, I'm going. You know, so I'm following. So they hand me a joint, because she was in the row to get the joint, so I got in the row to hand me the joint, and I start hitting on the joint. And then they hand me a beer, and I'm standing there with the beer, and I'm thinking, and I'm following the girl, and I'm hitting on the joint, and I look over at the beer, and I look at the joint, and I feel that coin in my pocket, and I went, God damn, God damn, God damn. I just ruined 6 whole months. I was mad as hell. I set the beer. I didn't even pop the top on the beer. I just slammed it down on the counter. And I wasn't going to waste the joint. I handed it off. And so I had, oh my God, I was mad as hell. I went out and sat in my brother's car for an hour and a half till he came out of the party. I was so mad. The next day, I knew I was going to have to come back and start over and pick up a new chip, pick up a white chip. I did not want to do that. I went to Butterball's Biker Bar. Butterball Pack's Biker Bar in Pensacola, Florida is a Harley-Davidson bar. These guys are, I don't know, they don't wear button-downs. They're not real polite. They love their Harleys. I walked through the door of the bar and I yelled at the top of my lungs, anybody ride a Harley-Davidson is a dumbass. This is the stupid, this is, I could not get anybody to beat my ass. That is the most miserable feeling. When you cannot get your ass kicked and you want it kicked, and then it gets worse. And you think that's bad. My brother is 10 years older than me. He was this tall, Mark. Fifth degree black belt in Aikido karate. He didn't really have to do anything. He put one hand in his pocket and go like this, and I'm flying all over the room all day. He could poke me one time. I'm twitching for 4 hours. Butterball yelled at me from the back of that bar, said, if you don't get your ass out of here, they're not going to kick your ass. I'm going to call your brother Mark and have him kick your ass. Oh, that's different. So I went to the meeting and picked up my chip. It was interesting. And that was September the 14th, 1992. Again, I was trying to do anything except do step work. I was trying to, I would look around, I called the guy. Charlie McDonald was my first sponsor, and this guy was incredibly well read. He was AA when he died. He had over 2,000 people in his funeral procession. And this is an old Navy petty chief, but he was so loved in this program that so many people followed him, came to see him. I looked around the corner to see if Charlie was there, and if he was there, I left. If he was there, I'd go to another meeting because I didn't want to have to do any step work. He was going to make me accountable, and I've never been accountable. I wanted to avoid it. But after I came back, after the 6 months, and I came back, and he fired me for not doing step work, and I had to get somebody who actually was acquainted with the book and would take me through it and help me to do stuff. And I did. I became willing. Only as willing as I knew, because I knew if I actually went back out again, it was going to be just as bad. I had spiral from really comfortable to living in a surfer flop house with dead rats under chairs. Oh, by the way, reverse at that time. Reverse in my car was my left leg out of the car pushing the car backwards. Life had gone from comfortable to not so comfortable. I wanted to make life better for myself. The selfish motivation was there. The damage that I'd done to family, to a loving mother who had put me through everything and had done everything to make my life well, I could never pay back the love and the kindness that she had given me. One of the things that I wanted to point out earlier when I was saying that you have to be willing to look at things on a different level. For me, the easiest way to do this is list the number of years I've been alive, one through that number on a page to start with, and then list every place that I lived. Okay. Then after that, I list if I went to a church in that area, if I went to what, that's what I did. I had to do it that way. So, and then I'd name everybody that I knew during those things. And then I'd look at everybody that I screwed over, all the train wrecks I caused, all the heartache I caused. That's the easier stuff too. You think that's hard, but to begin with, after a few minutes of doing it, you can get a little bit numb to that. But then we get to the hard part. Later, when you're going to talk to somebody else about it, after you've listed all this stuff, you're going to say, okay, this is what happened. I have a resentment at somebody. I'm angry about this. All right. Now, what's my part in my anger toward this other person? Okay. The people I've harmed, there's a lot of things involved in that. I hurt them. I was selfish. But it's not just saying that I was selfish. I stole money from my mother. Okay. it's not just that I'm selfish and I stole money from my mother. It's that I'm selfish and I'm so selfish that I wanted what I wanted. I wanted the alcohol. I wanted the drugs. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I didn't care about the consequences, and as a result, I was willing to steal from my own mother. That's the point. That's what step five is about. You go to another person and you talk about the exact nature. That's owning your mistake 100% and knowing it. At the core of your gut, you know what you did, and you know why you did it. And you want something different. You want to be different. When you get to step three, you're going to say you're going to turn your will and your life, your thoughts and your actions, your will and your life or your thoughts and your actions. But what is going to change as a result of doing this? After you do this, in the transformation process, what changes? Your motives and your priorities. You don't become a hole in a donut. When all the drugs and the alcohol are taken away and the other bullshit's taken away, the stuff that helps you be crazy and selfish and self-centered is taken away, you don't become the hole in the donut. You become something else. You have a different motive, a different priority, and you get to be helpful. And you get to be the person who stands by the door and helps the next person come into this program and do this deal. You know, I've gone into Holman Prison. I've gone into jails. I've gone into other places and helped take this program in. And when you go in, after you do your fifth step and you've seen a lot of stuff about yourself, you acknowledge that you have character defects. And yours are no different than mine. The people inside of Holman Prison who are in there are lifers. The problem, the things that they did, it's only matters of degree. To acknowledge and to think that they're worse than me or worse than anybody else is total bullshit. You know, the people who are there are there. I have to own I am who I am, and I'm here to be a and when you get to step eight, it says in there, our real motive, our real reason for doing what we do is to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. That's what we're here to do. And it's in step eight before we do when we go to make amends to people. When I go, I'm not going to say I'm sorry. They know I'm sorry. They knew I was sorry when I was a screw up. You know, that's not the deal. I go to them and what can I do to be as right for you? I acknowledge the mistakes that I made. How can I make this right for you? An amendment in the Constitution is to change a physical fact inside of that paragraph, is to change something. And you're changing a relationship with people who you harmed. So the real reason for doing an amends is to say, I sincerely want to be a different person. I'm coming to you because I sincerely want to be a different person. And as a result, I'm willing to do what you think is right for me to set this right with you. Now, you can't do that with everybody. I think if I, you know, stole a couple of pounds of cocaine from somebody, it would probably be a bad idea for me to walk into them and say, you know, I want to make this right for you. No, I think to recognize that that's the reason we have sponsors. You know, you go to your sponsor and you say, what should I do with this amends? Who should I make amends to? Here's my list of people. Here's the things that happened. Here's my resentments. Here's my fears. Here's my anger. Here's the things, you know, and the institutions I was angry at and all these different things. Your sponsor helps you understand and get balanced on all that, know what real is. But when you get ready to do amends, he'll also tell you some of these you can't make directly. Some of these you will not. All you can do is be as right as you can be and help people and help somebody else and not make the same mistake that you've made. I have an extreme gratitude to the people who came before me that helped show me what to do. And today I try to live in steps 10, 11, and 12. Step 10, the short form of step 10 to throughout the day. Anybody can do it, so you don't scream at a person in a car in front of you or get angry or run into the back end of them. There's a 5-question short form of the 10th step. What am I thinking? What am I saying? What am I doing? What am I thinking about saying? And what am I thinking about doing? You know, and then say, God, make me as right in this as I can be. You know, because, or you get a choice of not doing that. Don't do your 10th step. Don't do your 11th step. Walk around so tensed out you can pick up dimes with your ass cheeks. Pick. You know, it's up to you. You know, if you want to be that tense and angry or have be uncomfortable in your own skin, then don't do 10, 11, and 12. 11 is meditation, going to God, saying, God, help relax me, help me to know what right is, and help me to be okay through any circumstance, with my mother dying, with people, no matter what it is. I had to put my dog down 3 weeks ago. Whatever the circumstance, we have a relationship with a power greater than ourselves that can help get us through any circumstance. You come in here, you get to meet some great people, you get to have a great fellowship. And then in step 12, you get to work with other people. But to begin with, the best thing for you to do when you're new here is to get a sponsor and have them help you. It's really all I got. Thanks.
Thank you, Brett.
My faucet's dripping and I can't make it quit. The window's open and you're gone. I'm real tempted to do something rash, but it's too late and I'm so tired. Yesterday the crowd went home, we dropped them at the airport laughing and crying. As we watched the plane float off, it was just you and me and I burned up lying. Well, you gotta stop somewhere. Yeah, you gotta stop somewhere. One day it's all been done, and you gotta stop somewhere. Running into furniture and bumping into walls, and I'm wound up tight as a clock. Swing the door open and take a deep breath. Crank up the car and put it in the street. Well, I'm driving round and round, can't get lost cause I'm going nowhere. And I wind up leaning on the bar to hear the famous last words of another drunk poet. Yeah, you gotta stop somewhere. Yeah, you gotta stop somewhere. One day it's all been done, and you gotta stop somewhere. They give it 10 minutes to be a genius. My time is up and I'm busted. Busted for thinking slow, being stupid, laying low. Busted for being out of style. Well, I can't be king for a day. Not this way, not this lifetime. And I guess it serves me right